agenda, please. This is the Senate State Affairs Committee, and with us today, Senator Bert Stedman, Senator Johnny Ellis, and myself, Senator Gary Stevens. It's about 1:38, and we're going to deal with two items today, Senate Bill 112 and Senate Bill 102. For a motion to approve the CS for Senate Bill 112. So we
can go ahead and move that we use CS version F in lieu of the original bill on Senate Bill 112.
Thank you, Sir Stedman. Any objection to CS? All right. Record show Senator Wagner is with us. Thank you, Senator Wagner. We're on Senate Bill 112, and we have just brought the CS before us, and Mr. Harlemont is going to explain this to us. What were the implications of the CS? What it really does, Chuck, if you will.
For the record, my name is Chuck Harlemont. I'm with the Department of Revenue. I'm just going to explain the changes from version D to version F, CS. And, starting in section 1, line 8, section 1 is new, and it basically changes the application requirements for fund dividend to require a physical address to be presented to the department. And this is necessary to essentially enforce a tax like this, which is based on where you reside within the state, and certainly revenue has no other immediate means to make that determination, and so we're trying to, this attempts to create such a source of information on where people reside. Second change, section 2, line 13 of page 1 of the bill, minor technical change to specify when a person must be 21 to be taxable under the bill. And it says if you're 21 on the first day of the year, you're subject to tax. If you're turned 21 sometime during the year, you're not. On page 2, starting on line 7, the date which individuals who have not had the entire amount of tax withheld at the employer level, the day on which they're required to file a return and pay the tax, has been changed from prior to November 1 of the subsequent calendar year to January 15th of the subsequent calendar year. Accelerate it. Is that clear? I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Not very well.
Okay, I'll
speak up.
I will do my best, sir. The next change is on page 13 of page 2.
Page
2, line 13, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
And the original bill required that one half of the tax be withheld by employers in each of the first 2 months. This change comports with more traditional withholding practices. One, it requires withholding on paychecks so that employers can simply roll it into their normal payroll scheme, and two, it limits it to 10% of, to the lesser of, 10% of the taxpayer's gross earnings or one half of the tax per pay period.
Okay, would you explain that again? And what is the practical result, then, again, of a passage of this portion to the employee again?
Mr. Chairman, there are two practical results. One is to the employer, that many of them have payroll schedules that don't exactly align with a month, for example. And so it's more convenient, we believe, for employers to withhold on their normal payroll cycle. So it's now we specify withholding as being with normal payroll. Okay. And the original bill had just a flat one half of the tax is withheld at a chunk. That may generate some odd results when you have new employees or part-time employees. You could have their paycheck may not add up to the tax in certain instances. So the bill was adjusted to be more flexible to require withholding of the lesser of half of the tax or 10% of their gross.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. The next change is again on page 2. It starts on line 17 and that subsection C, 1, 2, and 3 are just provisions that give guidance to employers for withholding. It basically attempts to hold employers harmless in the event that, as long as they don't have to withhold, they're not liable for having failed to withhold if the employer demonstrates that they've already had their withholding from another employer, for example. Tax has otherwise been paid, or they're not subject to the tax because they're not 21 years of age on the first of the year. So
does the individual just say that it was withheld, or do you have to actually show some proof that it was withheld by another employer?
Mr. Chairman, the bill says that we will provide a form for the employee to use to give the employer. I think as a practical matter, that a pay stub's enough. You just want to. The trick here, from our point of view, in employment, in withholding arrangements, is to give the employer something they can count on to relieve themselves of liability. If they accept in good faith a document that demonstrates that they shouldn't withhold, they shouldn't be held liable. So, okay. The next change is on the same page 2, line 28. It adds a specific recognition that sometimes an employee will have more than the tax withheld if they have more than one employer. And in those instances, they can claim a refund from the state. And we've evaluated other head taxes and similar levies to this one. We more efficient if the taxpayer, the individual, comes to us for a refund as opposed to trying to work between us and the employer. We don't want to give refunds back to the employer. We want to give them straight to the employee who had excess withholdings. So, that makes sense. And that is it.
Thank you, Mr. Harleman. Senator Seven?
I'm just kind of curious, Mr. Chairman, on out in the hinterland, a lot of income is derived off of natural resources, fishing income. I'm just wondering how that was going to be handled.
Through Chair, the Senator Stedman, the bill doesn't actually direct those non-employee compensation arrangements. All I can say is when we've thought about it in other bills, including income tax bills and other head tax bills, our preference is not to impose a withholding requirement where none doesn't already exist. If there isn't a withholding, for instance, with crewmen, I'm sure you're aware that fishing boat owners do not have a withholding requirement on their crew.
I'm sorry, I had to speak up.
You may be aware that fishing boat owners do not have a withholding requirement for their crew under federal law, for federal employment tax, and we would not wish to impose one for a state tax as well. We think it'd be more efficient to just deal with the crewmen directly.
So it's the individual's responsibility, not the employer, or if you're a fisherman in the cannery you're selling to, it's the individual's responsibility to pay the tax.
That's correct.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Allister.
What was the reference to? Can you go over on page 2, the top of the page there, subsection B, in the 21 years of age? The bill proposes to tax anyone over the age of 18 with some form of income, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, my understanding of the bill is it taxes any individual who is 21 years of age or older on the first of the year who lives in the specified areas, and it doesn't have anything to do with whether you were employed or otherwise.
And why 21 instead of 18?
Sir, that's the way the bill written. It's
question
not
for the sponsor. And there on, if I could continue, Mr. Chairman, on page 2, line 10, individual salary or other compensation, that would be any other form of compensation, monetary or otherwise? Or just monetary forms of compensation? Or can you just speak, walk us through that?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, I'm not sure I can address your specific question. What this section relates to is if you have not had the tax withheld by an employer for whatever reason, the individual is liable to pay it directly to the state. And
I'm just trying to get a view of, I understand salary, but other compensation, is that just an overarching term that would include everything, monetary and otherwise?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, I think that's probably just unnecessary language. I'd have to look into it more. You know, other compensation in the context of an employer-employee relationship that requires withholding. I think it's just a clarifying term to salary. I don't see that it has any import.
Does compensation include other forms of benefit beyond salary?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, I interpret that to mean taxable compensation, but that's just my bias.
Not benefits of any kind.
That's how I would interpret it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Ellis. Could you just clarify for me what the employer's responsibility is? Can the employer ever be required to pay the employee's tax if they don't deduct it? I mean, this appears to me to be the responsibility of the employee, right? And somehow we're bringing the employer in and making them, allowing them to withhold it, but it still is the employee's responsibility. And I guess my question is, how can the employer be held accountable for any of this? And hopefully not.
Mr. Chairman, we're still working through details of the bill, and it's in a normal withholding statute, we feel that best practices are to impose a withholding requirement on the employer. If they fail to do so, the employer should be held liable, in our opinion. Or if an employer withholds funds from an employee and fails to pay them over, the employer should be held personally liable in that case.
The employer.
Yes. And you know, that is a normal mechanism certainly in the income tax, personal income tax field to, you know, you basically recruit employers as part of the administration of the tax. And they have specific requirements, and if they fail to, they can be held. They are liable for failure to withhold. It's not perfectly clear in the current bill. I think that was the intent.
So then the employer will just have to have an accounting system to show that every employee in that area has either filled out this form, has already paid it, or is not 21, or is has already had it withheld by another. So the employer, I guess what I'm asking, the employer then has to have a filing system that shows that every employee, and somehow either they withhold it or they have something on record that shows it's been paid before or directly or withheld directly by another employer.
Mr. Chairman, that is essentially true, and that's not unusual. I mean, the same basic requirements are in ESC withholding, for example. There's you need to keep track of and document what you did and did not withhold, and in cases like this where there's a cap to the amount, it's not just you withhold perpetually on a schedule. You withhold up to a point. You would keep track of those records as well.
Okay. So. Thanks, Harlem. Any further questions, Ms. Harlem? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
and washing our windows out here, so it's probably more interesting than what's going on up here, so enjoy yourself. And with that, Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, for the record, Tom Bundy, Senate District P. Thank you again for addressing the bill today. Just very briefly, I think there are two issues that this bill focuses on. One is philosophical and the other is fiscal. I'll deal with the fiscal first. We have all heard from various school districts the need for additional funding for our schools. And as you're likely well aware, the 54 school districts in the state, 34 of them, I believe it's, make some local contribution to their school. We have 19 rural education areas, REAAs, that make no local contribution to their schools. Department of Revenue information indicated that there was over $500 million in earned income in those areas. There are some areas like Dillingham who have chosen to incorporate and organize and make a local contribution to their schools, and they look upriver to places like Bethel who choose not to, and they begin to wonder about their wisdom of having to reach into their own pocket when a larger, perhaps more thriving economy is existing on the state funding alone. So I think fiscally this would generate more money. Some have suggested that there's not a lot of employment in rural Alaska. I've pointed out what the what earned income was in the past, and this really comes down to about $8.40 a week, or $35 a month, to support schools. And I don't think it's onerous, and I would point out that people in organized areas who are not people of means are currently paying various forms of taxes to help pay for their schools. So the fairness issue here is one that I think you should entertain as well. The other issue, as I mentioned, is philosophical. Human nature, to me, suggests that if you help pay for a service, you value that service more highly. You care for it more carefully. And I think that education is such an incredibly important, the education of our children is so incredibly important. We want to have more local buy-in, both on a fiscal and on a philosophical level. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Yes, Senator Ellis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So why did you choose to begin taxing people at the age of 21 instead of the age of 18?
I wanted to make sure they were well clear of the public schools and they were well out of high school. We admittedly could have chosen 20 or 25. 21 seems like the onset of adulthood for many other state requirements, and so that seemed like a logical place to start.
Mr. Chairman, if I
yes, sir.
Continue. And Senator Bundy, on the through the chair, you know, there at the end of the bill, we make clear the obvious that a dedicated fund would be unconstitutional. So the money derived from these areas won't necessarily go back to these areas for education. Do you intend this, and I want to give you a chance to say this clearly for the record, do you intend this to supplant existing general fund monies that we spend for education, or to be a true supplement, an increase in education funding, or some enhancement of education in these rural areas? Where do you, is it a supplanting or a supplement education funding?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ellis. I'm glad you asked that question because in my mind, it ought not at all be supplanting current funds. It ought to supplement or add in addition to current funds. I absolutely agree, of course, on the constitutional prohibition, but I think we can also, as we have in other issues, indicate legislative intent, and if nothing else, put a moral fence around these monies that they, unlike the original school tax that did not necessarily end up in education, that funds some estimated $13 million generated here would be in addition to current funding for education. And while I can't say that it specifically go back to the district that raised that money, it would add to the general fund support of our basic student dollar, and as a consequence, be of benefit to the population that raised the money.
Sure, I guess my, and I appreciate you being clear about that. I think we joined together in saying that if this were to come to fruition, that the that it would be a net gain for education, the overall state effort for education. But when we raise money in our community in Anchorage, and though we don't raise as much as we should or could, that money goes to support the local schools. If this money is raised in these villages, the it goes to the state and isn't necessarily improving or going for the schools in those areas. So it's sort of a, it seems like a difference between the local effort going for the local schools or going to the state treasury to be divided up, you know, according to the formula or according to our whims as a legislature. Any thoughts about that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ellis, certainly a good point. I would point out that these areas have been entirely sustained by the state for these many years, and as such, they were using dollars that could have gone to an organized area. And so I it appears to me that it'd be a long time before they get caught up.
Mr. Herman, just finally,
yes.
I know that if Senator Kukesh were here, and he's off on important business, but if he were here, he'd make the argument that, of course, almost all of the natural resources in the state come from rural areas of the state and come to the urban areas, and we all share those common property resources and the value derived from them. And so, you know, that's just something that needs to be remembered.
Mr. Chairman, it's another interesting point. I suspect if local areas were able to keep their resources to themselves, the North Slope Borough would be a very wealthy place, and the rest of us would be envious. So it isn't that the resources are all equally distributed in rural areas. They're certainly located specific areas. And you mentioned something, Senator Ellis, that is part of our Constitution, and all the resources are held in trust for all Alaskans. And so I think the argument is rather moot because they don't belong to the rural areas. They belong to Alaska.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Bunny, would you talk about the, we talked about briefly last time, the federal monies that come into these areas, PL8.
PL8-7 monies.
7 form, those funds. We've heard in testimony people say, well, we shouldn't have to pay a head tax because the federal government sends money to pay for our education for us. And would you comment on that?
Well, and again, I guess a philosophical question. If you're using someone else's money, I don't consider it a local contribution, and hence we don't get to the philosophical issue that I was suggesting is important of ownership. But the PL874 monies, the federal monies, don't come just to rural Alaska. They come to Anchorage as well, and they are passed through to the state. We're Anchorage to keep its PL74 money, which is substantial. I'm sure rural areas would object to that. So we could change the basic rules, but I think it would disadvantage rural areas if we did that.
So just finally, a head tax in no way jeopardizes those PL874 funds?
No.
Yeah. Thank you. Senator Stebbins, did you have a...
Just a brief question for the sponsor. I missed the first go-around on this bill, but is this legal? Well, we can impose a tax on one segment of our citizens and not on another due to their address. I mean, I understand where you're going as far as the desire, and I certainly agree that there's certain groups in the areas of the state and groups that in physical locations that could pay for school support that don't. They basically pass the buck on to other people. But I'm just kind of curious what the information you've had on the bill as far as the legality of it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman, certainly our legislative legal has not indicated any constitutional problems whatsoever. As a matter of fact, I would point out that we currently discriminate via our taxation. People who organize are required by state law to make a local contribution, and those that have chosen not to organize are allowed not to make a contribution. So if current practice is legal, this is obviously illegal.
The areas of the state that are in unorganized boroughs that do pay more or less voluntarily 4 mils of property tax to support their schools, then those people that have, or those citizens that have addresses from those areas, and would not be subjected to the to this tax because they're already.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Should you leave Sitka and move temporarily to work in a in an unorganized area, as a resident who's of an area where they're currently supporting your schools, you would not be expected to be double taxed.
Any further questions? And in summary, anything else you'd like to say, Senator Bundy?
Thank you. I guess I would refer again to the last few lines of the sponsor statement where I quote the Constitution, Article 1, Section 1, that reads, all persons have an equal, are equal and entitled to equal rights, opportunities, and protections of the law, and that all persons have a corresponding obligation to the people in the state. And I would just summarize by saying I believe this is a fairness issue, that it will provide opportunity, as we had an earlier testimony, for those who would like to make a contribution but don't want to have another level of government imposed on those, and it will provide an opportunity, I think, when people lobby for additional funds, for them to very clearly point out that they are making a local effort.
Yes,
Mr. Ellis. I'm sorry, I didn't think of this before. But through the chair, Senator Bundy, the couple of people that were speaking in support of your legislation at the last public hearing said that they were willing to pay this tax in order to stop you and me and whomever else is pushing for mandatory boroughs in some of these currently unorganized areas. And it sounded like they wanted us to make them a deal, that if this were to, if this tax were to become go into the statute, that we people would cease and desist. Do you have any thoughts about that? Because that seems to be what Dick Schultz is expecting, that if we pass this tax that he's willing to pay, and he said he might get lynched there in Tok, but he's willing to take the risk, that we would back off on mandatory borough formation?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ellis, I think Mr. Schultz is probably right in the political arena that this might dampen the arguments a little bit. However, as you all are well aware, nothing this legislature does can bind a future legislature, and should in future legislators, legislatures, they continue to pursue organization of unorganized areas. This might be a factor of discussion, but I don't think it will be the deciding factor.
So you at least would make no guarantee that the drive for mandatory borough formation in these rural areas would stop if we impose this tax?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ellis, no. There's no way I could make that guarantee in good faith.
Oh, you can only speak for yourself, I suppose.
Well, And as I said, we can't bind a future legislature, and people in rural areas may indeed one day change their opinion as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions, comments? Should this pass out of this committee, goes on to finance, where both Senator Stedman will be to continue the discussion, I'd request a motion to move it out of committee.
Go ahead and move that we move Senate Bill 112 to CS, Senate Bill 112, version F.
Okay. Legal recommendations and
legal recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Thank you, sir.
Object?
An objection?
Could I speak to my objection briefly?
Yes, please, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I know we've had a couple of meetings and hearings on the legislation. I personally am not comfortable that we've fully vetted this, especially on some of the mechanical issues, and I guess I can pursue that individually with some folks from revenue and get more comfortable or at least familiar with the details of how this exactly would work in the real world in rural areas in this state. So that's the basis for my objection.
Thank you, Senator. I'm sorry, I made a mistake here. Before we go on with this vote, we have one person who wants to speak, Mr. Kalinka. And Steve Van Sant is standing by for questions. Mr. Kalinka, are you there?
Yes, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm here again, and thank you for the opportunity to address that issue. I am the president for Alaskans for Efficient Government. However, on this issue, I speak solely on my own behalf. And I have a few comments. First of all, I'd like to thank Mr. Bundy for his effort to bring this issue to the forefront. As you all know, we always had a problem with funding for schooling. And I'd like to give you some food for thought. I personally always advocate against taxes as a rule. However, I'm all for user taxes. In other words, if you use a service, you have an obligation to pay for that service. Education is a service that is provided by the state to our children. And I fully believe that we need to take care of our kids, as I'm sure you already know from my past testimonies on other issues. Now, funding for schools and to enhance funding for schools, and of course, is the primary responsibility of the state. However, there are large segments of the population that do not contribute to that funding. And it has crossed my thoughts that the kids are the ones who benefit from it. So in other words, they are the user of a service that they presently get basically free of cost at the expense of the taxpayer. But each one of our children, guess what? They do get a permanent fund check. Now, wouldn't it be prudent if the state would take a portion of that permanent fund and use it for their education? That would distribute the burden equally on all of them. In other words, the fairness issue would become mute. Now, also, I heard in previous testimony that there would be a head tax. It would entail the employers getting involved and deducted from their paychecks, etc., etc. This all would become moot because the state already has the addresses of those individuals on file, and it would be a very simple accounting matter to deduct a certain percentage that you, the legislatures, would determine what it would be, and then there would be no problems with refunds, etc., etc. Now, this, of course, cannot be solely dedicated for education, as Mr. Bundy has so eloquently stated, and he pointed out all the problems and so forth, and I do not need to get into them. I'm sure you all know them better than I do. But
well,
I just...
Mr. Kalink, I appreciate your comments. I'd ask you to speak to the bill in front of us, and we're not considering at this point taking anything out of the permanent fund dividend, as I think you are saying. Could you speak to the specific bill in front of us? Do you favor it or oppose it?
I would be in favor of it with the reservations because I believe you're hitting again a segment of the population that is not using the benefits. So I suggest to you, you might want to investigate to make it a user tax and tax those people that are using the service, in effect our kids. That's all I got to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Link. I appreciate your comments. Mr. Van Sant, did you have anything you wanted to specifically say, or are you just here for questions?
Senator Stevens, I'm just here for, to answer any questions we might be able to help you with.
Thank you, Steve. All right. I apologize to Mr. Kalinka for not allowing him to speak earlier. We have a motion before us to move this on to the next committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note. We had an opposition to that. Is that still hold? And I'd ask for a roll call vote, then, please.
Senator
Stedman.
Yes.
Senator Wagner.
Yes.
Senator Ellis.
No.
Chair Stevens.
Yes. Passes in 3-1. As we move on to Finance Committee. Thank you, Senator.
Chairman, committee members.
Other controversial bills can we pass.
That is a novel concept, though. Make your children pay for education.
Tax the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Uwe's got us all trained to be anti-tax, but it's hard to turn on a dime there.
It is. All right, we have before us Senate Bill 102 relating to district coastal management programs, and we did adopt a CS that we dealt with last time, and Doug Letch is here. And Mr. Letch, speak to this issue, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Doug Letch, and I work for you. The CS that you have before you today is very similar to the original version of the bill. The CS does mirror a House Bill 189 that was submitted by the House State Affairs Committee, and the biggest difference in it is it'll base the deadline for district coastal program revisions and an element of the existing program upon federal approval of the state program by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration program, and we believe that the extension in the bill will, in the whole concept of SB 102, to extend the deadline for coastal plans to be submitted to the Department of Natural Resources for approval will help coastal districts in our state come up with a plan that their public has had the opportunity to look over and comment on, and will ensure an orderly and efficient transition to the new program that the state of Alaska and the federal government will agree on if that indeed happens. Where we left it at the last committee hearing on Monday was the department wanted some time to speak to the committee substitute, and Mr. Bates from the Department of Natural Resources is here to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Schleich. Any questions of Doug?
I've got one. Can you just briefly refresh your memory on how many entities have to submit the Coastal Management Program update, how many have done it, how many are in limbo, and then the ramifications if they don't get the extension compared to if they do get the extension?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I think Mr. Bates from the department will have all those answers for you, if I could defer to him.
Mr. Bates, would you come forward, please? Randy Bates, would you come forward, please? Thank you for being here again, and we had a pretty thorough hearing last time with comments from lots of communities, and would you restate your question, Senator Stedman?
So I'd like to just a refresher on the numerics of how many entities have to submit the plan, how many have done it, how many are still asking for an extension, and then I'd like to get down to, because at the last meeting I think there was lack of interest on your part for granting an extension. I'd like to know the ramifications if we grant the extension. That put us at a disadvantage with the federal government, or over the years dealing with planning and zoning issues, it always seemed to work better to err on the side of conservatism, granting adequate time for plan implementation and adoption.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Randy Bates. I'm the Deputy Director of the Office of Project Management and Permitting within the Department of Natural Resources. Senator Stedman, through the chair, to give you the numerics of the coastal district plan revisions. As I mentioned at the last hearing, there are 35 established coastal districts. There are 33 of those which currently have approved coastal plans. HB 191 required all coastal districts to evaluate their plans, review them, and resubmit them in compliance with HB 191 and the implementing regulations. Of those 33 coastal districts that have coastal plans, 27 of them have committed to making those plan revisions. Of those 27 that have committed to making plan revisions, we know exactly where 16 of them are at this point and when they will be putting their draft plans out for public review. And that 16 of those 27 are anticipated to put their plans out for review by mid-April. The remaining 11, we don't have firm dates, but we do expect that all of those plans, the remaining 11, will be out for public review by the end of April. Does that answer the question about the numerics of the district plans?
I can just one follow-up.
Yes.
How many are projected to meet the current deadline?
As far as
of the 20 of the 33 or 27 with revised plans, how many do you expect to meet the deadline, and as it currently stands, and how many do you think will not meet the deadline?
Senator Sedman, through the chair, we expect that, to the best of our knowledge, all 27 coastal districts that are making plan revisions will meet the deadline. As I mentioned in the last hearing as well, we made about $900,000 available for this effort for the districts, which in part funded their planning revision efforts. And part of that grant is that they have the plans done by July 1st, 2005. So as far as we know, those that we are in contract with will have their plan revisions done in time. The public review of their plans by the end of April will put them on schedule to get their plans submitted to us by July 1st, 2005.
Ms. Bates, we have before us that the CS. Have you had a chance to speak to that? Do you have any comments on the CS?
Senator Stevens, I don't have any additional comments on the CS. You have seen the additional fiscal note that we provided this morning.
Yes.
On that CS.
And do we have that fiscal note?
I do.
Yeah, it's in that.
Okay, did you want to speak to that, how that was arrived at?
Sure.
The fiscal note.
Okay, Senator Stevens, I'll walk very quickly through what the fiscal note for the CS, SB 102, looks like. We have federal funding, federal and state funding available for all of our current staff through June 30th of 2006. In fact, that was the date on which all ACMP program revisions were supposed to be completed. Those program revisions include regulatory changes, district plan submissions, and DNR's approval of those district plan submissions. The way the CS for SB 102 is structured, it delays the submission and the review and approval of those coastal plan revisions to a date that looks like it's going to be around June 30th of 2008. Recognizing it's a two-year delay, we do not have the funds to carry our staff forward for those additional 2 years. We lose federal funding as of 2006. Therefore, it results in a fiscal note for each of the fiscal years 2007, 2008. To retain those staff to review and approve the plans.
Thank you. So your belief is that if we were to pass this 1 year extension, it would be almost a $200,000 additional staff costs, department costs in 2007-2008.
Senator Stevens, actually, your CS extends it more than just a year. So it extends it 1 year beyond OCRM approval, and that moves it into the two-year time frame. So, but the answer to your question is yes, we will need additional funds.
You know, just a comment on the, I know we weren't all here for the public hearing we had last time. I just point out that to a man, everyone who testified from the community spoke in favor of an extension. And just so you'll know, they were Aleutians West, CRSA, and I'm sure I can't pronounce it right, but Sina LaRoute, CRSA, John Oscar, City of Craig, City and Borough of Juneau, Kenai Peninsula Borough, Kodiak Island Borough, Lake and Penn Borough, and North Slope Borough. And just a question then, Ms. Bates, what I heard them all say is that I heard some of them say that they could do this, they could submit it in a timely fashion, but that it would not be complete, and there would have to be revisions. And I've heard you say that that's acceptable, that there could be considerable revisions that come along through time. And I'm having trouble justifying this $200,000 for the next 2 years if they have a year to submit it, with what might be the case if they simply have to submit revisions. Won't there be additional costs there as well? and that in any way approach that $200,000 per year.
Senator Stevens, the fiscal note reflects the fact that one of the pots of money that we have within the ACMP is what's called the Coastal Impact Assistance Program monies. That was a one-time allocation that came out of Congress for states that had oil and gas exploration off their coast, OCS exploration. The monies that we have out of that CAP program are expire July 1st of 05. We have requested an extension of that grant so that we can maintain the funds and the people through July 1st of 06. Some of our key staff that are will be looking at these plan revisions, the mapping requirements that we've included with these plan revisions and the very basic enforceable policies are funded out of that pot. We expect that pot of money to be expired in July of 06. Therefore, we don't have the money to maintain those staff to carry them on that this bill would need.
Well, I guess my question is, if there are substantial revisions from the districts, and all of them seem to think there would be substantial revisions, that then you figure that you feel that that would be funded out of your normal staffing.
Senator Stevens, let me, if I could, let me make sure I understand what your question is. When I was testifying on Monday, I did make the case that, in fact, the districts can get their plan revisions done, and we believe that we've helped them along in that way, and I think they're in position to get it done. That doesn't, as I mentioned, that does not end the planning process, and this plan revision will comply with HB 191, get them an approved program, but it does not stop there. Districts can at any time continue to refine their coastal plans, and our staff is set up right now to complete the requirements of HB 191 through June 30th of 06. Some of our monies to keep those staff on will expire at that point. However, we've got staff remaining in place to continue to assist the districts with the very basic planning requirements that come along over the course of time, and we don't expect a massive onslaught like we have right now with 27 plans. When we get two or three a year, we have adequate staff to handle those, and that's what we would expect to occur in the future. It's just refinements of plans that our staff in 2007 and 8 could easily handle.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Ellis?
Chairman, Mr. Bates, if you could help us, or help me at least, understand the governor's position. I read recently that he was saying that, or threatening to pull the plug completely on the coastal zone program in the state if the feds didn't capitulate on a number of points, I guess, important to him, and that seems sort of like the nuclear option in all of this. And you've testified that you oppose the legislation, or the administration doesn't favor the legislation and the extension contained in it. Why are we heading for the showdown that seems so unnecessary if we pass the chairman's legislation and give this extension? It just seems like we could work this out in a better way than the kind of the head-to-head bully confrontation approach.
Senator Ellis, through the chair, I appreciate your question, and we have engaged in negotiations with OCRM, our granting and approving agency, for 2 years, and we tried to get them to the table early so that we wouldn't run into approvability problems or roadblocks like we have now. The unfortunate problem is that they didn't come to the table the way we expected or asked them to, so we are in the situation we're in. We have a very major philosophical difference between what Washington, D.C. wants in an Alaskan coastal management plan from that which the legislature in 2002 passed and what we promulgated for regulations implementing that bill. That it's a very basic philosophical difference where we want a streamlined, non-redundant program that works for Alaska, and we've found that OCRM is pushing us into a program that duplicates existing state and federal law. What we find within this bill, and one of the reasons that this administration opposes the bill, is that if we extend the time frame to for the districts or for OCRM to submit or find approval of our program, we are playing into the Fed's hands in forcing change upon the state. If we don't keep OCRM working hard, they're going to find that they can continue to push the state to a program that we simply don't agree with, that is not going to work for Alaska. And we want to be able to move forward and keep moving. And by giving OCRM more time the way that this does, I think that we're playing right into their hands for Washington, D.C. to manage our resources up here. That's one of the very primary reasons this administration opposes this bill.
Mr. Chairman, that's a bad sign for this being signed into law.
Mm-hmm. Certainly it is. Any further questions? Take a brief recess. Question or comments, question anybody has on the bill before us? Let you know, if this passes out of this committee, it would go to resources and then on to finance. We have somebody who wishes to speak to us, Sandra Harbank. Ms. Harbank.
Good afternoon.
You want to identify yourself, please?
My name is Sandy Harbanuk, and I live in Juneau. I did not come prepared to testify today, but I've been very concerned in listening to the administration's testimony or DNR's testimony here just a few minutes ago. I am a former coastal project reviewer with the the Division of Governmental Coordination, and later DNR, and I am currently employed as a consultant working on 7 of the coastal district plans. And I was present at the hearing on Monday. I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous because I don't do this every day, even though I live in Juneau and the capital's accessible. In fact, I live on the same street with you guys here. I'm up on 4th Street. I listened to the testimony the other day, and I was very disturbed that the coastal districts did not bring out some of the very major and significant problems that are occurring in rewriting these plans. There are not simple disagreements with OCRM. They're deep, they're profound. The regulations are what I would call stultifying that DNR has promulgated. It's very difficult to give you a catalog of the whole thing, and I guess that's why the districts did not bring it up the other day. The HB 191 has its own set of problems. The regulations that came out under HB 191 or after 191 are confusing. They don't comply with the standards that are set out in federal law. Districts are very constrained in what they can write policies about. It's a straitjacket on local participation in state and federal processes. You know, I could give you some real examples if I'd been more prepared today. I would be happy to provide you with some very detailed written material. It's been very hard because I don't like to speak for the districts because that's not my role. I'm writing revisions to their plans, but I don't represent them in that way. Anyway, I don't know if you guys have any questions, but what I just heard a few minutes ago was a total misrepresentation of what's happening. And if you can address it, I will thank you profoundly.
Thank you, Ms. Harbanuk. So it's your position that the federal and state governments are very far away from being in agreement, and that, in fact, it's the local coastal zone managers that are organizations that are trying to figure out what they do and where they go and how they write their plans when there's no agreement between feds and the state?
There are a number of problems. There's been changing guidance, continuously changing guidance coming out of DNR. There's very confused language, like determining whether an issue is legitimately and adequately addressed before you can write a policy about it. There's the problem of having to designate areas, and this is one of the feds' concerns, that policies can only apply to constricted areas, which force districts to do a bunch of zoning in advance of knowing what kind of projects might be coming down the line, what uses there might be for that land at some time. So the regs do their best to put a stranglehold on what districts can do. And I'm trying to keep myself from saying some immoderate things here. But.
Thank you, Ms. Harbin. So one other question I might ask you then is, if this were to be passed, a one-year extension, what would happen with that time? How would that time be used? What would you accomplish between now and a year from now that you have not accomplished to this point?
I think the districts could take a breather and wait for the changes in the program to occur and then write good policies for their districts. Some of those changes will definitely affect what kinds of policies can be written. The kinds of differences that the state and the feds have right now are differences that would affect what local programs can do. So my expectation is that they would work on the parts of the plans like resource inventories and analyses and wait for the changes to come out that would allow them to write programs, write policies that worked for their districts and have the participation process that all the districts spoke to the other day.
Thank you, Ms. Harbin. Any further questions? Thank you for your comments. Anyone else care to speak to us at this time? No one else on the calling in, so we have before us then this issue. I'd request a motion to report this matter out. It goes on to resources from here.
Let's go ahead and make a motion that we pass out of committee, Senate Bill 102, version G, with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes.
Thank you. Is there any objection to that? Very well. We'll pass that out, and thank you all for being here. Meeting's adjourned.